Well, this morning we embark on a new expositional series beginning in Genesis chapter 37. And as we're keeping our attention in the scriptures, we'll also be doing a study of the life of Joseph, because that's what Genesis chapter 37 through 50 is about. In modern day times, Joseph came from a dysfunctional family. That's a modern term, dysfunction, which simply mean by that sin makes people dysfunctional. And in that sense, we're all dysfunctional. All right? But when you find yourself in a family with a father who has three mothers and 11 brothers and a sister, and there's jealousy and there's envy and there's hatred and there's murderous intent, it makes for a bad recipe. There is no human reason whatsoever that Joseph should have emerged from this emotional and spiritual carnage of family to be the incredible man of God that he was. Think about his pedigree. Think about his heritage. No other 17-year-old could boast that his great-grandfather was Abraham, that his grandfather was Isaac, and that his father was Jacob. That's amazing, isn't it? And as you think about the life of Joseph, the only explanation there is for Joseph is the grace of God. He is who he is, he was who he was, because God set his favor on him. Well, that's not unique to Joseph, is it? Anything good about you this morning is due to the grace of God, right? Not because of any good in you, not because of some blessing you've had with godly parents or grandparents, regardless of how good that might be. God uses those things for our good, but it is God and His grace that makes us who we are. As we think about the life of Joseph, and this morning, I have a title for the first 11 verses. Certainly not a title for this particular message, because we're not going to cover the first 11 verses, but if I were to give a title to the first 11 verses, it would be Dysfunction, Dreams, and Divine Providence. Dysfunction, Dreams, and Divine Providence. And it is because the dysfunction is so large and so significant that we're going to spend our time considering the life of Joseph, his family, his upbringing, the things that affected him, shaped him, because you can't understand the life of Joseph without understanding his father. Now, it's interesting that there are 14 chapters in the Old Testament, this book of Genesis, given to tell the story of Joseph. More than any of the other patriarchs, more than Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And yet there are only, outside of Genesis 37 through 50, there are only four references to the life of Joseph in the rest of the Old Testament. And there's only four references to Joseph in the New Testament. And apart from one reference in John chapter 4, they seem rather insignificant. Jesus never quotes Joseph. Jesus never mentions Joseph. So, it seems a bit odd to us that there'd be so much attention given to Joseph in the historical record, but not the New Testament doesn't make much of his life. Look with me at verse 1 of Genesis 37. It says, "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan." This is the history of Jacob. Verse 2, Joseph being 17 years, and then it goes on with the life of Joseph. Now, I stumbled over that for quite a while in my study. If this is about Joseph, this is the history of Jacob? And the conclusion I came to is that you can't understand the life of Joseph without understanding the life of Jacob. Because when we are introduced to him here, and he becomes the focal point in Genesis chapter 37, he's 17 years of age. And there are only four brief references prior to this of his life. The first is when he was born to Rachel. The second is when his father, in fear of retribution of his brother Esau, word was coming that he was on his way with 400 men. Jacob divided all of his family into groups. Joseph's mentioned there. Five verses later, Joseph is mentioned as bowing before Esau when Esau met Jacob and all of his wives and children. And then the fourth reference is when he buries his father at the end of Genesis chapter 49 and 50. What's interesting about the study of the life of Joseph is that nothing bad is ever reported about Joseph. Now, let's not be mistaken. Joseph had a sinful nature just like every other human being who's ever lived. But we're not told of any outward expression of it. One of the most striking features of the life of Joseph is the number of points in which he is a type of Christ, Christ being the anti-type. Now, as I say that, I want to be clear that the New Testament does not reference Joseph as a type. But as we study the life of Joseph, typology is all over the place. You can't miss it. In fact, if you really have an interest in that, A.W. Pink's book, Gleanings in Genesis, he reserves, you ready for this? 68 pages to speak of 101 specific examples given to us in Genesis 37 to 50 where he sees Joseph a type of Christ. So that'll be rich. That'll be a part of our ongoing study. We don't want to miss that use of the literary device of typology. It's rich. The greatest single characteristic of Joseph was his absolute faithfulness to God in all circumstances. At every bad turn, and there were many of them, he never wavered. Never expressed doubt, never complained, never compromised. It seems that God was always the chief and determining reality in Joseph's life. Would to God that we could say the same. And what I keep coming back to is we're talking about a 17-year-old young man that we encounter here in Genesis chapter 37 and verse 2. Not a 40, 50-year-old seasoned, mature man. And again, what explanation do we have for that apart from the grace of God? From the life of Joseph, we learn a number of things. Let me enumerate a few. We learn how to overcome envy, how to face adversity, how to resist illicit sexual advances, how to plan for the future, how to forgive those who wrong us, how to dispel thoughts and doubts about forgiveness, to have faith in God's promises, to recognize the sovereignty of God even in the wrongs done to us by others. I think the life of Joseph is the classic Old Testament illustration of Romans 8:28. That all things work together for good to them who love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. A classic verse, Genesis 50, verse 20, where he says to his brother, "You meant this for evil." He wasn't letting them off the hook, even though God had a gracious purpose in it all. He wasn't getting them off the hook. He was holding them responsible for what they had done to him. "You meant this for evil, but God has meant it for good, for the salvation of many people." Providence is a major theme in the study of the life of Joseph. And what's remarkable about God's providence in the storyline is that God used such little things as links in the chain of circumstances by which He exalted Joseph to become the prime minister of Egypt and eventually to save millions of people from starving during that 7-year famine. He used a cupbearer and a baker in a prison. He used an unnamed man in the early verses of chapter 37 to even find his brother, to even be able to bring a bad report back to his father. And we'll spend a considerable amount of time tracing that theme of providence. When you come to Genesis chapter 37 and you're introduced, this is the history of Jacob, Joseph being 17 years old. Where did he come from? Where did he come from? Did Joseph have the kind of family background that we might expect to produce a person of such exceptional character? Answer? No. No, that's not the explanation. And when I say the only explanation for the life of Joseph is the grace of God, I want to elaborate a bit upon that is because he does have this incredible pedigree. That his great-grandfather was Abraham. That his grandfather was Isaac and his father was Jacob. That is not to be dismissed. Those are the patriarchs. Those are the men that God chose to enter into covenant with. And the blessing of God, the favor of God, the electing purposes of God that were upon Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, Joseph is a beneficiary of all of that. I think we're guilty at times of personalizing our faith to the degree that we minimize those who came before us, those who walked with God before us, and we dismiss or minimize the importance of generational faith. And if you happen to be here this morning and you have a pedigree, you have a father who walked with God, or a grandfather that walked with God, or a great-grandfather, a grandmother that walked with God, you need to be thankful. You need to be incredibly thankful. And to realize that in part you are the man or woman of God you are today because of God working through them. Right? None of us live on an island. And it's impossible to trace the influences that God has used. I'm not one privileged to have had a godly father or grandfather on either side. But be able to look at the family tree and be told of this aunt that was a God-fearing person, and to have in my possession her Bible and be able to go back and read the notes that she'd write in her Bible and how she was praying for her family. You don't know, do you, whether that prayer included me. But if you have those kind mercies of God in your life, be thankful for them. No, Joseph did not have the kind of family background that we would expect to produce a person of such exceptional character. Joseph was the first son of Jacob's favorite wife, Rachel, for whom Jacob had been willing to work 14 years. Jacob had another wife, remember? The Bible is an intriguing book, isn't it? You see the fulfillment of New Testament principles. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. Jacob the deceiver flees his brother Esau, goes to Uncle Laban. And who does he encounter? An upright, godly man who treated him fairly. No, an uncle who deceived him. He entered into an agreement that he would work for Rachel. And at the end of 7 years, in the wedding chamber, he discovered that he was with Leah and not Rachel. And he confronted his uncle about that deception and said, "Oh, you don't understand the culture here." Well, he should have told him that on the front end, right? Not on the back end. But he was willing to work 7 more years in exchange for the love of his life, Rachel. In Genesis chapter 29 and verse 20 says, "It seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her." That's some pretty impressive love, right? Well, Joseph was no doubt particularly cherished as a result of having been born to the one Jacob loved so intensely. But Joseph is not an only child by any stretch of the imagination, is he? Let's take a quick detour. It's not a detour, it's a helpful walk through Scripture, because as I said, there's a reason why God in His wisdom arrests our attention at the very beginning of 14 chapters to tell us the story of Joseph and starts with, "This is the story of Jacob." Joseph being 17 years of age and goes on. So God doesn't want us to blow past Jacob and just encounter Joseph at 17 years of age and try and make sense of his life. You've got to understand about the life of Jacob to understand about the life of Joseph. And as you understand more about the life of Jacob and the home in which Joseph was raised in, your appreciation for the grace of God magnifies, because where sin abounds, grace doth much more abound. What a glorious truth that is. And what a glorious truth it is to be able to see flesh out in a family. So, let's go back to Genesis chapter 29. We'll just speed through here, but I want you to see what's happened in this family. I've already mentioned the work agreement that Jacob entered into with his uncle Laban. and the trickery that he, his first wife was Leah, not Rachel, and he was willing to work 7 more years for Rachel. And in the meantime, almost as a consolation, that's probably a really bad word, consolation. Maybe a peace offering. Uncle Laban gives him a maidservant. This isn't something that Jacob took initiative in. This is something that was given to him. It says, verse 21 of chapter 29, "Then Jacob said to Laban, 'Give me my wife. My days are fulfilled that I may go into her.' And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. And Laban gave his maid Zilpha to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, 'What is this you've done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me?' And Laban said, 'It must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one also for the service which you will serve with me in another 7 years.'" So this one is Zilpah. "Then Jacob did so and fulfilled her week, so he gave him his daughter Rachel as wife also, and Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. Then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban still another 7 years." So there's this obvious love that he has for Rachel that is very conspicuous to Leah, and it creates all kinds of problems despite the fact that the man had more than one wife and shouldn't have. Notice verse 31. "When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren." The Lord saw. This isn't something that was imaginary in Leah's mind. It was obvious that Jacob's favorite was Rachel and Leah was second. Leah conceived and bore a son, verse 32, "And she called his name Reuben, for she said, 'The Lord has surely looked on my affliction. Now therefore my husband will love me.' And she conceived again," verse 33. "She conceived again," verse 34. "And she conceived again," in verse 35. Chapter 30, verse 1. "Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said to Jacob, 'Give me children or else I die.'" You're starting to see the dysfunction in the mess that's brewing, that Joseph's going to be born into. Verse 2, "And Jacob's anger was aroused against Rachel, and he said to her, 'Am I in the place of God? Who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?' So she said, 'Here is my maid Bilhah. Go into her, and she will bear a child on my knees, that I may also have children by her.'" So what's happened? Zilpah has borne Jacob 4 children, 4 sons. Rachel, in envy of that, she's barren. She gives Jacob Bilhah, her maidservant. And what happens? Well, there are 2 children born to this maidservant by Jacob. So there's now 6 children. Down to verse 7. "Rachel's maid Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son." That's the second son. "Then Rachel said, 'With great wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister, and indeed I have prevailed.'" Verse 9, "When Leah saw that she had stopped bearing, she took Zilpah, her maid, and gave her to Jacob as wife." So now there's going to be 2 sons born to Zilpah. So far we've got Leah with 4 children, Bilhah with 2, and now Zilpah with 2. So now there's 8 sons. Go on down to verse 20. I won't get into all the Madrax and all the fruit and all that and how that all figures in. But verse 20 says, "And Leah said, God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him 6 sons." So she called his name Zebulun. So she has 2 more children. Leah does. Afterwards, she bore a daughter and called her name Dinah. This is the only daughter born to Jacob. 1 daughter and 12 sons. Verse 22, "Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph." So, when you're in Genesis chapter 37 and you read this, this is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah. There were 2 sons born to each of these maidservants. So there's 4. Leah had 6 children, which makes 10, and a daughter, Dinah, which makes 11. And Rachel has Joseph, and later has Benjamin, and dies in childbirth. So that's the accounting of all the children. The home in which Joseph was raised was comprised of a family filled with angry, jealous, and deceitful people. Add to that, that within that hostile environment for 17 years, the other sons of Jacob had watched as their father played favorite with Joseph. Joseph's brothers had come to despise their younger brother so severely that they not even could speak a kind word to him. And that jealousy turned to hatred, and that hatred turned to murderous plot, as we'll see later on. You see the importance of going back and thinking through the life of Jacob so that we might understand better what's going on in Joseph's life. Let me trace some other things that were shaping influences in Joseph's life. Joseph was still a young child. And Jacob and his clan returned to Canaan. You remember that? Jacob saw that the countenance of Laban had turned against them, and he determined, we're leaving. We're getting out of Dodge. We're going back to the land of Canaan. God spoke to him and told him to do this. I can't find the verse, but trust me, God told him to do this. And this was not a peaceful journey. This was leaving in the middle of the night. Hurry up. Got to get out of here. Why? Well, because if Uncle Laban discovers that we've got a plan to leave, he is going to keep us from leaving. So Joseph's a young child, and he's resting either behind or in the arms of his mother, traveling on some burden of beast in the middle of the night. And what happens? In a matter of days, Uncle Laban catches up. And I don't know if Joseph was old enough to speak, and if he was, he might have said, why are we leaving in the middle of the night? What about Grandpa? This was his grandfather. What about Grandpa? Is he angry with us? Are we angry with him? I mean, those are some questions that we might entertain in our minds if Joseph was old enough to be able to articulate those things. Perhaps he was old enough to remember the confrontation that his uncle had with his father. What is this you have done? When Laban finally caught up with Jacob, you didn't even give me an opportunity to say goodbye to my grandchildren. Perhaps he overheard that. Then there was the fear and the anxiety that was caused by the threat of Esau. 20 years had passed since Jacob fled his home country to get away from his brother. And now he's on his way back, and word is Esau's coming with 400 men. I'm sure if it wasn't articulated and communicated, the fear and the anxiety was very much in the air. How could Joseph forget the evening of preparations when Jacob sat down and crafted this plot? Leah, you and your children. Bilhah, you and your two. Zilpha, you and your two. Rachel, you and me and Joseph. That was his plan. He had no idea whether Esau had a murderous intent. And if he did, he would have to get through the maidservants, Leah, and to get to Rachel, his beloved, and his favorite son, Joseph. He no doubt remembered how afraid he must have been when everyone was sent across the brook, Jabbok. Everybody except the last ones was Rachel and Joseph. And they crossed last and left Jacob on the other side. On the next day, Jacob limped across the river to lead his family to Esau. And if Joseph was old enough, no doubt, "What's wrong, Dad? Why are you limping?" "Because I wrestled with God until He subdued me and made me submit." What an impression these things must have had on his young mind. And how real God must have seemed to Joseph during those traumatic days. But this is not a godly family, any stretch of the imagination. You remember when Shechem, the son of Hamor, who ruled in the land of Shechem that they settled in when they returned to Canaan, had violated their sister Dinah, had raped her, and then expressed a desire to marry her. And Joseph's two brothers, Simeon and Levi, acted in deceit and entered into an agreement that they would give their sister if all the men would be circumcised, and they agreed to that, and they murdered all the men of Shechem. Murdered Shechem, married, murdered his father. And Jacob said, in Genesis chapter 34 and verse 30, in response to all of that, "And then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, 'You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I.' But they said, 'Should he treat our sister like a harlot?'" So what did Jacob do? Verse 35 says, "Then God said to Jacob, 'Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there, and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau your brother.' And Jacob said to his household and to all who served, all who were with him, Put away the foreign gods that are among you, purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone. When Jacob was still with Laban and was planning his departure, chapter 31 and verse 13, God spoke to him and said, I am the God of Bethel. This is God speaking to Jacob. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land and return to the land of your family. You remember that when he pitched his tent, laid his head on a rock, and the ladder came down? I'm sure that that story, that encounter, had been recounted to Joseph and other members of the family. And if not, it certainly was now when Jacob said, we're going to Bethel. Why? Well, because that's a significant place. That's a place where he met God. That's a place where he made vows. And he was going there to make sacrifice and recommit himself to God. Joseph was about somewhere 12, 13 years of age at this time. And he must have been profoundly impressed as Jacob showed him the spot where the great ladder had come down from heaven and touched the earth. And if he hadn't heard the old story, he heard it again as Jacob and his family held hands and recommitted themselves in covenant faithfulness to God. We're talking about shaping influences in Joseph's life that were used of God to make him the man that he was. Shortly after this, three deaths shook the family. First, Deborah. And who was Deborah? Deborah was Rebekah's aged nurse. She died and was buried under a great oak at Bethel. She had been a link to the past. When Joseph's grandmother, Rebekah, whom he had never seen, first came across the desert to be Isaac's bride. I don't know why, but there's no record of the death of Rebekah. God did not record that for us. But we have the record of Deborah, Rebekah's aged nurse, and she died. Second, we're talking about things that impacted and had a profound effect upon the life of this young man, Joseph. Second, his own mother died. Rachel was expecting a second child. The birth was difficult, and Rachel died shortly after giving birth to Benjamin. Joseph gained a brother whom he came to love very much, but he lost the most important person in his life. And a short time later, a third death occurred. Isaac, Joseph's grandfather, died and was buried in the cave of Machpelah near Mamre, where Abraham, Sarah, and Rebekah had been buried before him. This was the tomb of the patriarchs. And it must have had a profound impact and effect upon Joseph's life, because he returned 27 years later to the very same burial spot to bury his own father, Jacob. Now, these are some of the events that shaped his life and affected him. And in conclusion, let me say this. We can never exaggerate the importance of childhood events. So whenever it's within our power, we must see that these events are inducements to godliness. And when these events are outside of our control and power to change them, we are responsible for how we react to them. And may we do that as believers, trusting in the goodness and the sovereignty of God, and thus demonstrate the transforming reality of God in our life. Character is formed in an early age. Joseph, his character is formed at 17 years of age, and what we see flowing out in the preceding chapters is that life manifesting itself. Let me speak a word to our young people this morning. If you are here and you are a young person, Joseph was a young man, 17 years of age. Perhaps there are things that have happened in your life that you are personally responsible for. But perhaps there's things that have happened to you that you're not responsible for. There are things that have happened to you by someone else. Or you've lost a grandparent. You've lost a parent. You have perhaps a father or a mother who isn't sympathetic, doesn't understand, doesn't encourage you in the things of the Lord. Don't let those things be a roadblock and a hindrance to you. Because where sin abounds, grace doth much more abound. Perhaps you're surrounded by brothers and sisters that are not a godly influence upon your life. They're a hindrance to you. Well, Joseph had the same. Didn't doom him. God worked in spite of his family, his brothers. If you've heard the gospel, if you've had the privilege of hearing the gospel, understand that it is a privilege. There are people in this world who will live and die and never hear the name of Jesus, let alone his saving purposes. So if you've heard, you've had that privilege, understand God is reaching out to you in kindness and mercy. He wants to rescue you. He wants to save you. He wants to give you a purpose for your life. And you can shine in the midst of the difficulty and the darkness you find yourself in, just like Joseph does. God moves in a mysterious way His wonders to perform, doesn't He? Well, pray with me as we continue to make our way through this study. I'm excited about it. God has met me in the study. I'm looking forward to bringing the fruit of my study and God meeting with me here for your benefit and your edification. Let's bow and pray. Father, I thank you today that you're the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that your grace does rise above sin and dysfunction. Your grace does rescue. Your grace does sustain. Your grace does keep. And Lord, we don't need to look just to the life of Joseph to see that. There are people sitting in this place today who are living testimonies of that. That you in your electing love reached in and snatched them out of a family. Snatched them out of horrible circumstances, made them trophies of your grace, and you have kept them ever since by that same grace. Lord, cause us to rejoice in a God who rescues sinners. A God who rescues sinners for His own glory. Recalibrate our hearts today. If we're living for ourselves and living for some worldly ambition, if you've saved us, remind us afresh that you saved us for your own purposes and for your own glory. And help us to embrace that and to live that out in the midst of our circumstances, whatever they might be. And if our circumstances are different than Joseph's, favorable, may it, all those things be cause of great rejoicing. Thank you for your word. Thank you for its instruction. Thank you for its help. Thank you for the life of Joseph, this man that you set your affections on and had purposes for and have preserved his life for our instruction and for our edification. Use these things, our Father, for our good and for your own glory, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.